these things that we scrutinize on a daily basis. And he was saying, you know, I don't know, are you the right person for that? And it got me thinking. I was like, maybe I'm not. So long ago, I declared a moratorium on women's magazines, only in the dentist's office. I figured there, it's okay. Vogue is okay in the dentist's office. But I didn't look at them anymore because it was messing with my mind. But I went back to them for the purposes of this, and again, it was an enlightening experience. So I just want to share with you some of the messages that you all know and you get from the magazines, but how coming back to it from, you know, 5 years of not looking at them and 5 years with no television, how it affected me and what I got from that. So what I learned was that to make myself perfect, to get the perfect body, I know I can do it, I just have to try harder. This was the message I got. So try harder, what does that mean, according to the array of women's magazines? Avoid carbs at night, carefully weigh my portions, no more sugar. There are so many helpful tips on talk shows and magazines and online. That's why I'm sure I can lose those last 10 pounds. It's just 10, who knows why, always 10. I mean, if I added 10 minutes to my workout, I could flatten my belly, no crunch is necessary, with the aid of portable resistance bands and convenient exercise cards that fit right in my wallet, so there's no excuse to skip a workout, even while traveling or on vacation. After all, fitness is a way of life. Those are all direct quotes culled from a variety of magazines. So, interestingly enough, although I scrutinized my wedding photos for every little flaw until Rick snatched them away from me and said, you better stop that, I am missing my left leg, and when it comes to this particular point, all of the magazines that are profiting and helping me fix everything that's wrong with my body fall strangely silent on this particular point. In fact, disability is entirely absent from the popular literature of glamorous aspiration. If you don't believe me, just take a look around next time you're in the dentist's office at the magazines. Occasionally, it appears as part of a cautionary tale about what could happen if you don't wear your bicycle helmet, or telling you how to prevent birth defects if you're thinking about starting a family in between Pilates sessions. That's about it. So these tirades that we give ourselves, I could change this about myself, I need to try harder, more crunches, more time at the gym, it's a kind of a list in your head, right? It's a litany of self-loathing. I'd love my body if, with no mention of what you might actually like about yourself, because whatever it is, according to Elle and Mademoiselle and Shape and Self, it could probably be improved. So I'd love my body if, it's that if that does it to us, it's that if that launches us into this bizarre, endless competition with ourselves and with each other to see who's better. But what are we competing for? What does the winner win? Sexier, more vibrant hair, younger looking skin, a better beach body you can show off with confidence. Confidence and happiness, that seems to be what these things are going for. Is that what we want to buy? Can we buy it? Is that really what they're selling in the glossy, seductive pages of those women's magazines? If you do know these litanies, if you talk to yourself in a self-defeating, hypercritical way, however facetiously you may do it, you're not alone. According to Caroline Knapp, who's the author of a wonderful book that I recommend to all of you, more than my own, is Appetites, Why Women Want. She says that at least 80% of women wake up every morning aware of an anxious stirring of self-disgust for a variety of reasons. We fixate on the feel of our thighs, on things that we've done, the feel of our bellies, who we are, the feel of our hips as we zip our pants and skirts. Women are 3 times more likely than men to feel negatively about their bodies. And so we wake up, for whatever reason, with these abusive little tapes chattering away in our heads as we try to make it through the day. Students, professors, CEOs, actors, waitresses, engineers, flight attendants, mothers, accountants, and doctors. Nobody is immune, regardless of education or socioeconomic status. Self-loathing seems to be a universal sickness. And the voices calling for a cure, the voices saying, love your body, are regularly drowned out by the voices that say, love your body if. Peddling a sickness, peddling you that if. So I'm sure you've all heard your friends doing this to themselves, attaching moral value to food, like, I'm so bad, I ate that cake, or I did this, I'm such a terrible person. They play the tape, they make the list, subjecting themselves to volleys of self-abuse. Family members, too. How do you react? Do you agree with them? Wow, you're right, you really are a bad person, and you do have a big butt. No, of course not. What you do is remind your friend or your mother or your sister of their smarts and strengths, of the things that make them beautiful and unique, their smile, their laugh, the way they tell a story. You shift the focus from the externals to the internals, to the richness and uniqueness and worth of the individual human being. Because despite what we are told, and far too often come to believe, that is the real object of lasting love. And when you reassure them like that, you believe it, right? Yeah. Yes. You're like, no, actually, I do think they're terrible. No. I know I believe it when I tell my friends that, how wonderful and beautiful they are. Because I don't scrutinize them the way I do myself. My tirades, my little tapes, they're not about them. They're just about me. So why? Why is it so difficult to extend that same compassion to ourselves? My worth as a person has very little to do with my body, and certainly very little to do, nothing at all, to do with whether or not it looks like the cover of a fashion magazine. I know this intellectually, but I don't always feel that way. So loving your body if is all about potential. Loving your body without the if is harder. So it requires acceptance of our limitations and realities. It's not something that happens because it's a good idea. Love Your Body Day is a great idea, but it also sounds like a command, right? Love your body! You! Love it now! It's like crazy's boot camp class or something. It doesn't work, right? Because me telling you to love your body or printing Love Your Body on the cover of a magazine or a product label does not make that hard choice easier. And there's some irony there, right? Some contradictions. In every issue, again, of these magazines, Self, Women's Health, there's an article encouraging women to, just last month, love yourself just the way you are, no matter what size or shape. And on the opposite page, an article or an ad about fixing you, transforming you, and improving you. Linking self-love to transformation, implying that self-love is in fact impossible without radical changes being made. At best, this message is confusing. Which is it? Love it or fix it? Which bodies are lovable, even more importantly, and which are not? And why invite someone to speak on Love Your Body Day who's still so ambivalent about her own body? When she's bought into so many of these social and cultural and commercial messages, even though she knows they're not true. Question. Ever since the publication of my book, Poster Child, which, as Elizabeth mentioned, is a memoir about growing up with a permanent disability, I find myself all the time in the very awkward position of encouraging other people to love their bodies. I frequently receive emails from women and men struggling with their own disabilities or eating disorders or chronic pain. I hear from war veterans a lot, from people with disabled children a lot, and from disabled spouses probably the most. Sometimes they thank me for telling a story about living in an unconventional body. I haven't really figured out what that is, but that seems to be the phrase that's used a lot. Or for being inspirational in their own quests to love their bodies, no matter what they look like. Inspirational is a problematic word for me, for a number of reasons that I'll talk about later. But one immediate reason is that so many times I shut down my computer after sending a thank you note to one of these lovely people, and I feel like such a hypocrite. I don't want to discourage them, but I also want to be honest with them that it's not easy for me. Not just because of my disability, but because of my battle with anorexia as a teenager. Of course I want people to take away something positive after reading my book. And I truly am excited about the idea of helping people love themselves just as they are. And yet so many mornings I wake up with this terrible self-talk, convinced that my path to happiness, worthiness, and love must lie in physical transformation, as if striving for some arbitrary conception of perfection will exempt me from aging, changing, and dying. This is the message of those magazines and miracle creams, and this has duped all of us in a big way. And it can be a daily struggle to pull back that veil. I was born with a disability, as you all know, so this preoccupation with the physical self, the external self, began really early for me. But as is the case with most of us, it intensified during that graceless period called puberty. So I'm going to read you a section from my book about the time when I began to view my body as an object of shame. And this story is about something that happens to me that makes me realize how different I really am. And what you need to know about this section is just that at the time, I had a very non-state-of-the-art, literally wooden leg. I mean, you could have put it on a fire and it would have been like, you know, blazing for like 3 hours. It was made of wood and metal, and it had a foot that screwed on literally with a great big screw. So when my dad would have to tighten the screw, or he would oil it with little WD-40 in the garage, it was very, very rudimentary. Part of that had to do with where I lived and my parents' economic class, because I know you've all seen the prosthetics, the crazy, like, super prosthetics on TV. Yeah, we didn't have those in the 80s in rural Wyoming. We had wooden legs there. So me and the Vietnam vets, we had our little wooden legs. So in this chapter, I'm about 14, wearing my gorgeous wooden leg with the metal hinges. So the fun of showing off my body to my girlfriends at slumber parties rapidly disappeared when they discovered all that private, intimate pairings with boys could lead to. When a boy touched them a certain way or kissed them deeply for the first time, I believed that the girls who had once admired me began to see me the way I assumed that boys did, the way I did, and that was in comparison with the photographs in fashion magazines. After everyone had fallen asleep, I'd almost always have insomnia, having chattered away for hours and eaten too much chocolate. I was also kept awake by fears for my future that, although very present, also felt distant and indistinct, like thunder that can be heard everywhere around you, even as the exact location of it remains unknown. All you can see are occasional bright flashes of lightning in the windows. Sleepless, I was seduced by those beautiful magazines. I saw myself in those poses and locales, wearing that skirt or that dress or those shorts or jeans, and always those perfectly normal and lovely legs. What had made me special as a child, I knew I'd now give anything to trade for what my friends effortlessly possessed. Normal bodies, two legs, and, I thought, the possibility of a life with a man and a job and babies, the only future that I could imagine. The bulk of my fear stemmed from one particular incident that had led me to believe that this desirable life would always elude me. One Friday night, I found myself babysitting Sophie, a 4-year-old girl. I was chasing her around the corner when I felt something catch in my ankle, followed by a soft cracking noise, as if I'd stepped on a pine cone or a fallen tree branch. And then the foot was spinning around as easily as a merry-go-round on its axis. I knew the foot could move when forced. The year before, I'd been in a car accident, and the force of impact had turned the foot all the way around, as if the left leg were trying to walk away from the crash in the other direction. Sophie scurried out of sight, and I bent down. The foot swiveled in circles at will as I tried to steady it. When I realized the damage was too severe to fix, I limped back to the couch in the living room and announced that it was time for television. After Sophie was asleep, I tried to figure out what was going on with the foot, but I couldn't. The minutes ticked by. When Sophie's parents arrived home, I had to explain to them what had happened. I spoke to the floor, too embarrassed to look them in the face. Apparently, they had not even known that I had an artificial leg, and now I was literally falling apart in their family room. They paid me far too much, and I walked to the door, trying to look composed and nonchalant, while I dragged the loose, turning foot behind me. I prayed that it would not fall all the way off, taking with it my remaining dignity. Sophie's father watched me struggle for a few moments and then offered to carry me. I nodded, accepting his offer. He lifted me in his arms. It was the closest I'd ever been to a man who wasn't a member of my family. His chest felt solid, not soft, against my shoulders. It was not at all how I had imagined a strange man's chest would be. I felt the pressure of his hands against the back of my legs and the warmth of his body through my shirt. My left foot dangled like a booger from a nose, pulling on the ankle as if it would tumble to the floor at any moment. His warm arms were strong and straining under my legs and back. The image of a man carrying a woman in his arms was one I'd been taught to think romantic, but this was not how I felt now. I had imagined being swept away by a man who desired and loved me, like Deborah Winger in An Officer and a Gentleman. Now this stranger was carrying me like a wounded bird, a broken doll, and I felt ugly and strange and horrible. part of me was missing, and the compensation provided by an artificial stand-in that made me at least temporarily physically whole seemed disastrously insufficient. The presence of a leg's replacement only called attention to its glaring absence. An artificial limb merely intensified my awareness of the part that had been lost and no longer existed, the part that had to be reconstructed under a technician's hands. I had never internalized this truth until that moment, held and carried in the arms of a man whose first name I can't even remember. After Sophie's father left me in the living room at home, I cried for hours in full view of my family, and I could not tell anyone why. I felt isolated and strangely violated. I felt desire for the man who had held me, although it was inappropriate, and I thought it would be impossible for him, or more important for any man, to desire me in the same way because of my body. If I winced every time I looked at the scars and stitches or saw my limping reflection in a mirror or store window, how much more grotesque would I seem to a boy or a man who did not know the history of my body, but was assessing it on appearance alone? The stage of romance seemed one on which I simply did not belong, one on which there would never be a part for me to play. Instead, I would forever be behind the curtain, mollified and invisible, useless, shameful, ugly. My parents were mortified. Dad was angry, as if the leg had done this on its own, and suddenly adopted its own mind, deciding to betray me at the worst possible moment. Mom kept her arm around me, saying, "Oh, honey, don't cry." But crying seemed the only sensible response. "It's not your fault," she said. It didn't matter whose fault it was. I was deeply, deeply embarrassed, as if a piece of humanity had been scratched off of me, or had it been denied me, and I was angry, so angry, that I had to let some of it out, or I felt I would not be able to breathe. The rest of it I kept bricked up inside. For years I tried to remember the warm and steady pressure of that man's chest against my arm and my shoulder, and how it felt when his chin bumped against the top of my head. I held to that moment, afraid that he might be the last man who would ever touch me. As a child of a pastor, I committed countless biblical verses to memory. I spoke them aloud, feeling the ancient words roll and bounce in my mouth. As I learned them, adding a construction paper link to each verse I memorized until they circled my room like a ring of dull lights, they were simple word reels I unwound in moments of distress, as known to me as the patterns of my own breath and equally calming. In my mind, I saw the words with the small chapter and verse mark between them, so I knew the line well enough from Ecclesiastes: "What is crooked cannot be made straight." In this moment, with my body exposed in front of not a doctor or an x-ray technician or a family member, but a stranger, the loss of my leg and its implications for the rest of my life fully registered for the first time. I would never be made right or restored to true wholeness, not ever. A missing leg suddenly made all the difference in the world. It was the deciding, perhaps eliminating, factor. I understood the Vietnam vets I knew, now better than I ever had. Although I had not lost my leg at war, I knew how it felt to think of a life full of possibilities, any that your imagination might conjure up, and then have those notions destroyed. I knew now what it felt like to wake up to a body that changed your future and your options, and you could do nothing about it. Now I understood why the vets had told me their war stories in careful, whispered tones. The only way to partially redeem the loss was to remember it, although even this retelling brought with it its own wretchedness. My loss was never more clear to me than on that day I was carried home in a strange man's arms. Complete and irretrievable loss was just that. It was permanent. The body has a remarkable ability to displace pain. First it's in the abstract, then it's in your skin as a feeling, before it moves into your mind as a story. But sooner or later, the pain ends up in your heart, and that's where it stays. Words spoken aloud in your moonlit bed, crippled, deformed, unlovable, find their own darkness and then come back for you. So I don't think too many people in here can relate to having a leg fall off. I'm just guessing. Yes? No? Okay. So, but I think that the point of this story is to show that we all have stories that have marked us, whatever they are, that made us feel ashamed, incidents that grew into larger narratives about who we are, about our value in the world. For me, although it built on other experiences of feeling on the outside, This story was in many ways the birth of what I like to call a text of terror as it relates to the physical body. In many ways, it's still with me. Our litanies, the ones that are so damaging and dangerous, take shape when these texts of terror become part of our identities, part of how we situate ourselves in the world. I am this, but not this. I am smart, but I am ugly. I am good, but I am stupid. I am this, not this. We reduce ourselves to categories, to either or. We compare ourselves with the people we see on television and in magazines, and when the comparison is inevitably less than flattering, or when we are excluded, we assign ourselves a low rung on the ladder of desirability. Caroline Knapp, in her book, describes the American woman. She suggests that body loathing is who we are, and that as women, we learn to take ourselves apart. This metaphor works really well for me. I've worn my artificial limb for 30 years. I literally take myself apart each night and reassemble myself each morning. And I would love to be able to simply love my body when faced with its sometimes inconvenient reality. I wish I could simply just get rid of the negative self-talk. But I'm not sure that's realistic. Love your body is an important message. But sometimes it makes me feel like a failure. Another goal I failed to achieve, another difficult to reach standard, like a perfection of attitude instead of a perfection of body. Now I can berate myself for that too, for not loving myself. So shifting focus from the externals is important, but it's not always possible, at least not every day. And even if we get better at making the shift, the constant external barrage, the world around us, our image-saturated culture, most likely will not shift because fantasy sells, and we know it's a fantasy. We joke about airbrushing and how nobody really looks like that, and we don't see the representative population in the magazines, but we've come to accept these images. They're an impossible norm, and they can destroy us. Caroline Knapp, who struggled with anorexia as I did, asks in her book, what is this drive to be thinner, prettier, better dressed, other? Who exactly is this other, and what does she look like beyond the jacket she's wearing or the food she's not eating? What might we be doing, thinking, feeling about if we didn't think about body image ever? I can relate to this, and I know some of you in the audience can as well, or maybe you know someone who struggles with an eating disorder. But at the age of 14, I began to keep food intake journals. I discovered calorie counts in one of my mother's nutrition books, my mother, a longtime dieter, and I calculated in secret. It was like watching porn, you know, calorie counts. I cut out pictures of models in magazines. I tucked them into the sides of my mirror. I took off my clothes. I pointed out all the places where I came up short against an ideal of beauty that I did not question, even though my body was not reflected in any of those images. My anorexia lasted for about 3 years, but it was at its worst just before I went to college. And this was my typical schedule at the age of 17. Wake up, 100 sit-ups. Breakfast, dry toast and Diet Pepsi. History, PE, study hall, trig, lunch. Salad with no dressing, one piece of fruit. English, theater, yearbook, a free period in which I drove home and slept for an hour, obviously. Aerobics, 300 jumping jacks, 200 sit-ups, dinner, one piece of broiled skinless chicken, homework, bed. I wrote that down every day, too, which is a little obsessive. Meticulously, I recorded the events of each day, calorie count first. I placed some parts of my body under constant scrutiny, examining every dimple of fat I might find, every little bit of flab, but I neglected the artificial leg or the residual limb within it. I couldn't control the fact of that leg, but I could whip the rest of my body into line by refusing to give it what it needed until it got smaller and obeyed me. Between my junior and senior years in high school, I dropped 15 pounds in less than 3 weeks. By graduation, I was 5'7" and weighed 95 pounds. When a doctor commented on my rapid weight loss at my yearly checkup, I said, "Well, you know what they say about a hollow leg," and I knocked on it. He found this so funny that he repeated my joke to the nurse as I left the office, my stomach rumbling. Clearly, my obsession with food was a deflection designed to draw attention away from the real and scary questions just beneath the surface. What did I want to do? Who did I want to be? As a disabled woman, how was I supposed to understand my place or role in the world? What did I want? What do we want as women, as individuals? There's so much emphasis on externals. All those diet and exercise plans, we're told, finally get that body you always wanted. The body we want, but what is it? And what is wrong, really, with the ones we already have? This mantra, "you can do it if you try," taps into the myth at the heart of American discourse about identity and achievement. Many successful people, motivational speakers, and especially right now, politicians, talk about our country as the place of the American dream, which simply put is this. If you work hard enough, if you're tough enough, you can overcome anything. You can achieve great things, which is often understood, although not always, as synonymous with achieving wealth and power, not so much with becoming a generous human being or a better sister, brother, or wife. We're told that in this dream, there are no barriers of class or gender or race. And yet all of us know that this is not true. That there are millions of people in this country who work hard all of their lives and are never able to, quote, pull themselves up by their bootstraps into anything beyond subsistence living. People without health care who live in squalid conditions. People would have a lot of things to say about their dreams and desires if they had the luxury of time to pursue them or the energy to think about them after a grueling 14-hour workday making minimum wage. We know this, but we mostly ignore it. This is also how we're taught to regard our bodies. We're told that despite your genetics, your lifestyle, your income, your interests, and probably your health, you too can look like a sexy cover model. You only have to try. The American body dream. A few years ago, there was a horrifying reality TV show, they're all a little horrifying, this was especially so, on Fox called The Swan. Contestants underwent plastic surgery, cosmetic dentistry, fitness training, and of course, therapy, because not only does the team of specialists, including plastic surgeons and cosmetic dentists, try to help enhance these women on the outside, but also on the inside. While the doctors and fitness trainers work on the body, therapy sessions and coaching will help improve these women's self-esteem. End quote. So for 3 months, the experts transformed ugly ducklings, that was never described, into beautiful swans, also never described, filled with confidence, culminating in a beauty pageant in which one woman was crowned the ultimate swan. In this show, transformation is the yellow brick road that leads to happiness. For me, the swan echoes another kind of narrative. The ever-inspiring story of the disabled athlete who didn't let disability stop her from becoming a champion, a triathlete, or a marathon runner. We're all familiar with this kind of story. It's one of the most popular story about people with disabilities. She overcame her disability, and now, because of her athletic prowess, she is almost like one of us. She is almost normal. I'm not really trying to mock this kind of achievement. It is inspiring when people excel in extraordinary ways. But there is a reason why sociologists call this mode of depicting disabled people the super crip syndrome. The paradigm is meant to be instructive. You must overcome disability, never admit weakness, never back down, which ties in perfectly with this idea that if you work hard enough, you can have whatever you want. But the paradigm can also be destructive because that simply isn't true. It negates the real rage and fear that can result from having a different body, disabled or not. It avoids the very real pain of being stared at or painted in literature and movies as sad, grotesque, and sexless. There's a reason people don't want to hear the real story about disability. It's because we will all be disabled at some point in our lives. If you live long enough, age and sickness catch up with you, and the line between disabled and non-disabled is just a car accident, a disease, or a decade away. The body will change, and it will always do so in ways that we can't anticipate and that we cannot stop, no matter what we do, no matter how hard we try. I mentioned fantasy earlier. We like body fantasy because we don't want to hear the real story about our bodies. No matter how fit and gorgeous and healthy we are, someday we will die. This is the real reason for loving your body. It's the only one you have, the only one you'll ever get, and you'll never have it for as long as you would like. But instead, we're taught to believe that if we just lose the last 10 pounds or shape flat abs or get buff and bad, she likes you cut, says a recent issue of Maxim magazine, then we will go to the paradise of the transformed body. But as the writer Charles Baxter once said, paradise is not a story. It's about what happens when the stories are over. Think of that girl you know only eats popcorn, who's always at the gym. Think of that friend who berates himself because he's not buff and cut like the magazines. Think of yourself and the miracle it takes for you to get through the day. What would we do, what would we think about, if we weren't trying to make our bodies and ourselves perfect? And what if they already are? What if simply being human is already enough? Instead of trying to, quote, get the body you've always wanted, what would it feel like to love the one you have? What if you spent one entire day not worried about your body and how it might be better? What if for one day you really decided to replace every phrase of critique with one of compassion and love? What if we freed ourselves from the myth of transformation, and instead of trying to fix what we thought was wrong, we just didn't fix anything? Imagine what you might get done in that day if you weren't engaged in this game of distraction. I know I would write more, read more, think more deeply. What if you spent your time trying to know your own heart, who you are, where you belong in the world, what you're feeling, what you want, what you're driven by? What if we spent our days trying to come up with creative solutions for the problems of our time, climate change, war, the human rights abuses that occur every moment all over the world? Maybe I can't always stop myself from reciting those texts of terror or critiquing myself in front of the mirror, but I can make that effort. Because even if we can't love our bodies every day, we can at least try to stop these tirades, this violence against ourselves. After all, it's us doing the talking. Because self-disgust erodes you, like water rushing over rocks for so long that they begin to change their shape. These litanies of abuse, these texts of terrors, have affected me. It's a joke in some ways, what I would change and critiquing my wedding photos, but it's not always a funny one. A lifelong preoccupation with appearances has its cost. Worries about the way I look, about never looking right, about not being enough, have affected my creativity, my relationships, my quality of life, and I know I'm not the only one. So the question we must ask ourselves is, if today is Love Your Body Day, what will we make of every other day? I invite you to make that choice for yourselves and for each other.